When are people going to see that nothing ain't never going to change unless somebody finally makes up its mind to stand up and fight? Damn.
Netroots Radio presents Hopping Mad with Will McLeod and Arliss Bunny. Now, here's Will and Arliss.
Welcome to Hopping Mad. I'm Will McLeod.
And I'm Arliss Bunny. So today was supposed to be a whole different show. The fact is that as things keep evolving, we try to stay on top of that as much as possible. So today, instead of me talking about the emoluments clause of the Constitution and Trump's conflicts of interest, Will and I, in fact, both are going to be talking to you about fake news. And our interview today is with the incredibly fabulous Charles Gaba, Brain Wrap, if you are a member of Daily Kos, and he'll be talking to us about the ACA and what's in line for that and what we can be looking forward to with Obamacare. But first, one of the questions is there a difference between fake news and propaganda? Lots of people have been talking about fake news lately, but they haven't spent a lot of time defining it or talking about sort of what they mean when they talk about fake news. So I wanted to start there. The definition of propaganda, it's a systemic form of purposeful persuasion that attempts to influence the emotions, attitudes, opinions, and actions of specific target audiences for political, ideological, or religious purposes through the controlled transmission of deceptive, selective omission, and one-sided messages, which may or may not be true, via mass and direct media channels. The definition of fake news is news that is designed to look like a credible journalistic report, but is completely made up and with headlines that are purposefully targeted as clickbait and are intended to go viral. So examples of fake news would be something like Hillary running a child sex ring out of a DC pizza shop, the fake news sites Your News Wire, Tap News, and USA Newsflash created fake news stories along these lines, put them up on Facebook, and received an estimated 100,000 shares per post for each of them. Another example of fake news would be Democrats wanting to impose Islamic law in Florida or Pope Francis endorsing Donald Trump. Easily the biggest problem with fake news is that Putin's puppet, also known as Donald Trump, tweets it out and repeats it as if it was valid. That's the biggest problem with fake news right now. PolitiFact gave Trump the 2015 Lie of the Year Award for what they referred to as his body of work, which cracks me up. They have rated a full 70% of his claims as mostly false, false, or pants on fire. He is less truthful quantitatively than any other major politician. BuzzFeed has done an analysis of fake news and determined that fake news received more shares, reactions, and comments during the final 3 months of the campaign than did the real stories from the New York Times, Washington Post, and CNN. Facebook and Google searches were the primary means of dissemination. Using Facebook to leverage various sites, a man in Los Angeles told NPR that by generating fake news and putting ads on his sites, which pay based upon traffic, he was able to earn between $10,000 and $30,000 a month, showing quickly that many of us are in the wrong line of work. A computer scientist in Georgia, as in Georgia the country, posts both real and fake news on his sites, and he refers to it as a gold mine. Facebook's COO, Sheryl Sandberg, feels claims that Facebook swayed the election are not true, but she does say they are looking into the problem and evaluating several different approaches for dealing with it. And we think, okay, so a lie, fake news goes out there, but we can debunk it, right? Well, yeah. But here's an example about debunking that has to do with, for instance, Hillary's health. The Daily Beast ran a widely read piece, which soundly debunked rumors about HRC's health, and it reached 1,700 Facebook accounts and was read 30,000 times. However, the original piece, which proper not links to Russian sources, reached 90,000 Facebook accounts and was read 8 million times. The Oxford English Dictionary, the OED, selected post-truth as the word of the year and defined it as the state of affairs when objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. This is such a prevalent and important topic, that it is being addressed not just by media, but by the freaking Oxford English Dictionary. It's that big a deal. And I think it's important to say just really quickly that opinion and discourse, in other words, disagreeing with the GOP, that's not fake news. That's not propaganda. That's talking about it. That's having an argument. We get to do that. That's what the First Amendment and the founders intended. But there is a difference between discourse and actually lying. And so one of the things I really thought about when I was doing this is hopping mad propaganda? Well, yes, in that we do mean to influence your opinion, but no, in the fact that we never seek to disguise our bias, and we go to great lengths to bring you factual information based upon multiple sources, and we additionally purposefully seek to draw our information from reliable sources, which themselves have a fact-check process. So every source is going to have some level of bias, and we as consumers are responsible for paying attention to what that bias is and making sure that we understand that when we determine whether or not we believe something or not. Is fake news always propaganda? Well, yes, false is false. And anyone making the effort to actively promote it without checking it more deeply bears that responsibility. But all fake news isn't equal. In the Cold War, intelligence services started talking about things that they referred to as white propaganda. White propaganda is directly produced and distributed by known foreign government sources. So in the case of Russia, that would include sources like RT, Pravda, TASS, Sputnik, and some direct announcements made by the Russian government themselves. When you get to then something called gray propaganda, you're talking about false information, which is distributed by a source which does not identify itself as an arm of the foreign government. So when we talk about a lot of these forces, like Zero Hedge, Ending the Fed, WikiLeaks, and some things Will is going to talk about in a little bit, those are gray propaganda sources. Then there are just liars with an agenda. And these are guys that aren't necessarily directed by a foreign government. They're just lying for a reason. And that would be people like the Drudge Report, Breitbart, Alex Jones, and InfoWars. And then finally, there are useful idiots. And these are people who share or spread fake news and propaganda without realizing what they're doing. They just pass it along without paying attention. All of this really came to a head with me when I read a post on Naked Capitalism called We're Under Attack. And I am a big follower of Naked Capitalism. I read them all the time. I trust them, not implicitly, but for the most part, I trust them. And for the most part, I agree with much of what is said on Naked Capitalism in terms of financial news and economics. But on November 9th, what I consider to be an online community, and there'll be more discussion of this later, I suspect, which runs a site called Prop or Not, posted a list of 200 websites it considers reliably echo Russian propaganda. In that list, they included sites like Naked Capitalism. On November 24th, the Washington Post ran an article which they say describes the controversy of fake news, but which, if you read it, most of us, I think, would naturally read it as backing the Prop or Not list. The Post did ultimately add an editor's note at the top of the article, which stepped things back a bit, but in general, it looks, for most intents and purposes, like they believe the Prop or Not list. Prop or Not is sketchy. They are not a long-established news source. They are entirely anonymous. Many of their communications are juvenile at best. Their methodology is interesting, but can be weak. It's not investigative. It's numeric. And all of that being said, they're not necessarily wrong. Or they're not necessarily completely wrong or completely right. It's not a black and white thing with them.
Yep.
They have called upon the U.S. Justice Department and the FBI to investigate all the sites on their list under the Espionage Act, which I think is a bit much, but I do think that they are not wrong to be shining a bright light on fake news and the danger it causes and where that fake news comes from. I think that's absolutely critical. And even though I don't entirely buy everything they've said, I think their having brought it up is a service. And in that way, I support that. Eve Smith, who runs the Naked Capitalism site, points out that the Post and Prop or Not appear to be pushing to have sites designated by Prop or Not as fake news sites included in the proposed Facebook and Twitter link bans. And while I do think Facebook and Twitter need to get serious about looking into how they designate fake news and how that is treated on their sites, I think that before they do that, they need to carefully evaluate what sites get included in that algorithm, so to speak. Eve feels her site is on the list because there were Clinton skeptics, and she states that naked capitalism is facing a wholesale attack by the Democratic establishment. Frankly, the Democratic establishment has bigger fish to fry. They're not paying attention to naked capitalism. They just aren't. I understand why Eve feels that way, because she swam against the Clinton tide during the election, but I suspect she's developed an oversensitivity at this point in time. I do not believe it is a Democratic establishment attack. Naked capitalism does refer to the idea that the election was strongly influenced by the Russians to be a quote-unquote lunatic conspiracy theory, which would make it the only lunatic conspiracy theory ever to be confirmed by 17 different U.S. intelligence agencies. Nevertheless, Naked Capitalism is a really important site, and its coverage of financial news and economics is, as I said earlier, easily among the best on the web, and I stand by them as a site, even when I don't agree with absolutely every aspect of their thinking. Naked Capitalism is not a tool of Russian propaganda, but neither are they under direct attack by the Democratic establishment. I think it's important, again, we have a consumer responsibility. Each one of us has to pay attention to everything we take on board. In other words, there's some things that I just believe wholesale. There are other things that I can be influenced by to some degree, but I don't completely buy. And then there are things I just pitch out the door. So I think all of us have levels of that. And we need to take that with us when we go to consume anything, particularly things on the web. And I now have a quote from PolitiFact's Lie of the Year post, their 2016 Lie of the Year. And their 2016 Lie of the Year was fake news. That's what they awarded it to. And this is the end of that post. Quote, the fact-checking model presumes that audiences are equally interested in the truth, and all politicians are concerned about being caught lying. But 2016 exploded that. Trump exposed a way in which it can't work, which is when you overwhelm the system with a refusal to be embarrassed by saying things that are not true, that suggests something new and dangerous. In the weeks since the election, a public conversation has emerged about post-truth politics, specifically how to encourage truth and bat down falsehoods. Quote, what we need to do is to figure out a way to deploy the weapons of truth as effectively as other people are deploying the weapons of dissembling, end quote, said political correspondent Glenn Thrush on a recent episode of the Diane Rehm Show. While Trump garners as much support with his party, some conservatives say he needs to be confronted on his falsehoods because they lead to authoritarianism. People who are credulous enough to believe fake news will also believe and follow elected officials who lie. Brendan Nealon, a professor at Dartmouth College who studies fact-checking, said that studies show people are willing to update some of their beliefs if presented with contradictory information. Fact-checkers and people who care about democratic governance have to keep asserting the importance of accurate information even as the media figures out new ways to tell the truth in more compelling ways. Quote, there's a real darkness here if we give up on the facts, Nealon said. Standing up for facts is a kind of patriotic act, and it is a necessary one, unquote.
If I could cut in here, the problem is that we are not standing up for facts in a way that is actually effective. You can't just tell people that what they believe is wrong. You have to make them feel something first. Democrats don't know how to message. And unless our media is willing to make people feel something before they tell them different information, it's not going to have the effect that we want it to. So we've got to be sensitive to what people are feeling, and we've got to use what they are feeling and their lived experiences as a way to tell them what the truth is in the larger context of policy or international relationships or whatever it is. And what I'll say about Eve Smith over at Naked Capitalism is, well, let's talk about real quick. The way that these Proper Not folks worked was really interesting. If you read their report, they started by going to the absolute propaganda houses of you know, the Russian government, Russia Today, various other things. Sputnik, we've mentioned them before.
TASS, they started Pravda. Yeah.
Yeah. They started there and they worked their way out. And they hit on sites like Zero Hedge is one of these
Ending the Fed was another one.
Yeah, and the way that Naked Capitalism got caught up in this was they were pointing to Zero Hedge and saying, look how wrong this is. For what it's worth, Propernot appears to have removed Naked Capitalism from their list of Russian propaganda groups. And I think that's definitely appropriate considering I looked through their reporting at Naked Capitalism on Russia when they would comment on Ukraine, when they would comment on Russia, and they have not engaged in propaganda. They have quoted people who I disagree with, but they have never just uncritically pushed a specific narrative on their website. Naked Capitalism, while I do think that they are wrong about certain things when it comes to international politics, are not a propaganda site. Period. Full stop. They're trustworthy on financial stuff, too. I think they're one of the gold standard progressive sites when it comes to, you know, their stories on finance. Now, as it relates to international relations, though, one of the things that Eve Smith said was that Counterpunch, Truthout, and Truthdig were sites that deserved respect and were largely respectable. And so I thought to myself, you know, I don't really read any of those sites. So what I did to look and kind of vet what Propernot is doing was I looked at these sites and tried to see if I could find any Russian propaganda. And unfortunately, I did. I found lots of propaganda on all of these sites. I found that Truthdig, Truthout, and Counterpunch seem to have consistently pushed a pro-Russia and pro-Kremlin view, even when it means excusing attacks on civilians. They tend to hand wave everything away. And I'll just go through three stories right now. Neocons and the Ukraine coup, posted to Truthout on 25th of February, 2014, referred to what was going on in Ukraine as a neocon-backed event and mentioned that this was oligarchs and all this other stuff. And you know, Truthdig has said that as well, you know, compared these folks, you know, oligarchs fighting other oligarchs, except that if you look at who the oligarchs were in Ukraine, they were the ones trying to make a deal with Yanukovych. Because if Yanukovych could get brought down, then so could they. The reason that Yanukovych eventually left the country was because the people in Maidan, in the square, one of them stormed the stage and said, if you do not remove Yanukovych tomorrow and use your votes in parliament to remove Yanukovych, we are going to get guns and we are going to do it ourselves. This was after they'd been hit by sniper attacks from the government. They maintained their unarmed, nonviolent stance. They didn't have guns at that stage. And they only threatened to get them after they were attacked by snipers. Government snipers, by the way, that were Ukrainian military special police folks.
Important clarification.
Yeah, because that's another thing that we're going to deal with. So to say that this is oligarchs and, you know, neocon-backed nonsense, that's not factually true. There was an organic people's movement that threatened violence, at which point the oligarchs said, yeah, we got to throw Yanukovych under the bus. That's what happened. Counterpunch probably has some of the worst propaganda I've seen in a long time, and I'm really glad I didn't read this back in 2014 because I would have been furious. March 4th, 2014, Cry Me a River, where it not only excuses the assault by Russia on Ukraine and the seizure of the Crimea. It says, here's something you won't read in the mainstream media. Ukraine's fake revolution is over. It ended when Russian intelligence agents uncovered a plan by coup plotters to destabilize the Crimea using the same strategy they'd used in Kiev, that is, seizing government buildings, inciting violence, and spreading terror. I'm sorry, this is completely false. And you can tell it's completely false because the entire revolution was live streamed on the internet. You can find videos proving this wrong if you want to go and look with your own eyes. They basically are pushing this that what happened in Kiev, that Maidan was some kind of CIA-backed thing designed to set up a U.S. puppet for the purpose of, here we go, the Ukrainian revolution was a big fat fraud engineered by foreign intel agencies, subversive NGOs, and voracious globalist oligarchs.
And for those of you who don't know, Will has been covering this since back in his days when he was on The After Show. He's been covering this for a long time. So he's been paying attention to these news sources for real news sources and to what's going on the internet on this subject for a long time.
Since 2014, I've been watching this happen for years. This post is so egregious. When it comes to the Crimean Tatars, who, by the way, I've reported on this program that Crimean Tatars are being disappeared by the Russian government in Crimea. We know that's happening right now. And we know that's happening because Amnesty International is raising the alarm about it. You know what this Counterpunch post calls the Crimean Tatars? Tatar jihadis.
What?
Yeah, this Counterpunch, supposedly trustworthy left-wing news site, is referring to Tatars as jihadis.
That's insane.
Yeah.
They're a minority like the Kurds. They've been, and the Russians have disappeared them before.
Yeah. Oh, and you know who they blame for the sniper attack? They say it was Nazis. They say it was Nazis that carried out the sniper attack on the people in Maidan, when there are videos showing uniformed Ukrainian soldiers stepping in and engaging in those attacks, where the local police backs off and the Ukrainian military moves in. And those were people moving from positions that were protecting the presidential palace. If it's true that the people who fired at the crowd were Nazis, then they were Nazis that were under the command of Yanukovych and were standing shoulder to shoulder with his soldiers.
It's crazy.
And there are videos showing uniformed Ukrainian military, Yanukovych's military, firing on people. But we have this blatantly false, obvious false post at counterpunch.org. So yeah, Counterpunch has absolutely engaged in posting false Russian propaganda, really obviously false Russian propaganda, by the way, that you can disprove with a Google search and finding a few videos about. Truthdig. Truthdig, in their reporting on this, has engaged in something that's less than truthful. Now, what's interesting is it's a post by Mark Ames. And you may remember Mark Ames was working with Matt Taibbi at a satirical English language newspaper in Russia. Unfortunately, it seems like Mark Ames has a very, very Russian perspective on this. He essentially backs the Russian nationalist position that anyone who wants Ukraine to be a country is a Nazi. And the quote in question, where he's going after proper not, is "Eroya Slava," is a statement, or "Eroyam Slava," depending on if I'm pronouncing it correctly, is a statement meaning glory to the heroes, used by Ukrainian folks in the square. One of the most amazing things I've seen was on one of the nights of Maidan, they were carrying coffins with dead children in them who'd been killed by their own government. What they cheered that night was glory to Ukraine from the stage. And then the people in the crowd responded, glory to our heroes, meaning the dead children they were carrying in coffins that day. To refer to people complaining about their children being murdered as fascists for complaining about their children being murdered is insane. But that's what Mark Ames is engaging in here. He is pushing the traditional Russian nationalist line that Ukraine is not a real country, should not exist, and anyone who says so is a Nazi. So I don't know why Mark Ames would be pushing that perspective. I don't think it's true, but it's.
But this is back to, as a consumer, we each have a responsibility to be smart about what we take on board and to pay attention. Because in this era of fake news, until the media works it out, in other words, until they figure out how to get us consistently well-sourced news, we have to do it for ourselves. And that's incredibly hard. And the dangerous thing is that most people don't have time.
Yeah. And I think one last thing to say about Truthdig, Juan Cole is a prolific poster there. And what he does consistently that I find very frustrating is he always hand waves away anything the Russians do wrong. I don't think he's dishonest, and I don't think he's a Russian propagandist. I do think that he posts things that are way too pro-Kremlin and way too pro-Russia because he excuses their actions. There was a situation where it says, I'm just going to read this, the Russian air war against Al-Qaeda in Syria, the Nusra Front or the Support Front, took a tragic turn on Saturday when a missile hit a downtown government building complex and prison in Marat al-Numan. It left some 51 or more dead and 70 wounded. And it continues on about how this was a civilian site that was hit and innocent people died. And then it says the U.S. critique of the Russian strike, however, is just misdirection and hypocrisy. It's both sidersism. I oppose the Russian airstrikes in Syria, but the fact that Russia is clearly hitting al-Qaeda-held territory, The U.S. pretends that al-Qaeda doesn't exist in Syria or that it isn't the threat that Daesh ISIS is. But al-Qaeda is a more dangerous to the regime than Daesh and is generally a dangerous organization that reports directly to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the mastermind behind the 9/11 attacks. This post made by Juan Cole is typical of what Truthdig does, which is anytime the Russians do something wrong, well, yeah, but the U.S. is just as bad.
Yeah, that's that classic both-siderism that Professional Left, their podcast, does such a fabulous job of covering.
Yeah, and that's the thing. The one thing I want to say about this, about left-wingers who feel the need to protect Putin, who is a neo-fascist right-winger, the one thing I'll say about this is you cannot be a part-time progressive. You cannot decide that something is wrong when the United States does it and is excusable when Russia does it. You can't at once say that we shouldn't criticize Russia or complain about Russia, but also that democracy matters.
Exactly.
You have to be consistent. And unfortunately, for a lot of left-wingers, there is no consistency on Russia. We have to be equally critical of what our country does as what the Russians do. And unfortunately, there are a lot of left-wingers out there who have been willing to try to do the both sides nonsense. And that means that they have repeatedly, the Truthdig, Truthout, Counterpunch, posted false things or Russian propaganda. And I think part of it is that they're not critical. Part of it is that anything the U.S. government said is automatically suspect in their mind. And part of that is that some of them, like that Counterpunch report, Crimea River, are someone actually blatantly posting Russian propaganda as they've been accused of by Propernot.
Yeah, absolutely so appalling.
The final statement about Propernot is, I wish that they were a bit more critical themselves on these posts. And I don't think it's appropriate for them to go after naked capitalism. And I don't think it's appropriate for them to say that all of these websites need to be investigated for Espionage Act violations. But when it comes to the fact that U.S. sites are intentionally or unwittingly boosting Russian propaganda, they're not necessarily wrong. And as Arliss said, we have got to be critical. We have got to use critical thinking in this time of fake news, even when it's stuff that's coming from our own allies or people that we perceive to be our allies.
Absolutely. Next up, our interview with Charles Gava here on Hopping Mad. On Hopping Mad, and today we have Charles Gava, known as Brainwrap on Daily Kos, and Charles underscore Gava with a coveted blue check mark on Twitter. Charles became nationally known as the one person in media who thought to compile ACA sign-up numbers and the associated data during the earliest months when Obamacare was first going live. It turned out to be such a complex task that it ate into the time he was giving to his web development business. In grateful response, the Daily Kos community raised funds to compensate Charles for at least some of his valuable time. The results of Charles' ongoing work can be found at acasignups.net, and his web development business can be found at brainwrap.com. If you, like me, appreciate all that Charles has done to promote and spread the success of the ACA, you can support him now at GoFundMe at acasignups. Charles, welcome to the program. We're so thrilled to have you back. We think of you as a friend of the show, so thank you for coming back with us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
While the GOP had originally promised their voters that the ACA would be gone in the first 100 days of the new administration, it seems that they are amidst what I'm going to call a come-to-Jesus moment, because suddenly, instead of just creating imaginary monsters, they actually have to govern. Can you give us your best pass at the different directions they're being pulled in terms of healthcare?
Sure. And, you know, and again, thanks for having me on again. So, yeah, basically, there, as I can see it, there's really four ways that they could conceivably go here, two of which involve immediate full repeal and two of which involve partial repeal. And the thing is, no matter which way they go, bad things will likely happen as
sure.
a result. So if they go with an immediate repeal of the entire law, which itself would be very difficult to do because there's Senate rules and because they don't have because of the filibuster and so forth, most likely they would only be able to use the reconciliation process to repeal part of the law immediately, and the rest of it would require assistance from at least 8 of the Democratic senators. And I won't get into the sort of the wonky rule stuff, but the bottom line is, unless they decide to kill the filibuster outright, which seems unlikely, they would have to wait and get some help from Democrats down the line to do a full repeal. And the problem is that a partial repeal, as strange as it may sound, could actually cause more damage than a full repeal would, which itself would be bad enough. Because if they do a partial repeal now, they would be taking away things like the subsidies and the Medicaid expansion, all that sort of stuff. But they would be keeping the things that people claim to like, which are things like no denials for pre-existing conditions and that sort of thing, community rating and stuff like that. And that would basically cause the dreaded so-called death spiral that Republicans have been warning would happen with the ACA all along. Their actions would actually cause that to really happen. And so, whereas with an immediate and full repeal, which probably isn't going to happen, that would still cause millions of people to lose their coverage, because in the Republicans' mind, a full repeal without anything replacing it, they think that would just reset everything back to where it was, you know, in 2009 in healthcare.
They actually think that?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's what they think, because that's the impression I get. But what they don't seem to understand is that is not what would happen for a variety of reasons. One example would be with Medicaid expansion. About a million people who are on Medicaid now through the ACA's expansion were actually transferred over from existing programs. That is, not every one of them was uninsured previously. There's about a million or so of them who were previously enrolled in various state-run low-income, you know, healthcare programs, and they shifted over from whatever those were over to Medicaid. Now, Medicaid is better coverage and so forth for them, but they did have something before. Well, those pre-existing programs that they were moved from, most of those have basically been defunded or shut down by now, you know, because they aren't
right.
needed anymore. So just this summer in Louisiana, there were, you know, something like 200,000 people who were shifted over to Medicaid through expansion. About 200,000 of them were already enrolled in some sort of a state-run or locally-run program. It was bad coverage, but it was something. Well, a lot of those have been shut down now because, you know, it's been taken off their hands. So you'd have millions of people who they can't go back to what they were on before. But the bigger problem is that the entire industry, all the health insurers, they have completely changed everything for the ACA. They've uprooted their computer programming, their billing systems, their actuarial tables, you know, all sorts of sort of internal stuff has been completely overhauled once just in the last few years. And this would be requiring them to completely rip up all those new rules and switch them over again. And it just doesn't happen that way. And it would be, if people got very upset when a few million people, you know, lost their current policies and had to switch to a new one, this would be that on steroids. Because you'd be talking about 10 times as many people.
Which, actually, then I have a follow-up question, because I don't think people are clear that when the GOP talks about we want to keep the good parts of the ACA and get rid of the bad parts of the ACA, I don't
right.
think they understand that the insurance companies have driven the marriage between these two things. In other words, you cannot keep everybody with pre-existing conditions insured and in the pool, you know, as a requirement to insurance companies, and not compensate the insurance companies with a really big pool of people.
Exactly. And the metaphor that's commonly used to describe how the ACA exchanges work is the three-legged stool. And the idea is, if you envision exchanges as a three-legged stool, one of those legs is the individual mandate that everybody hates. Basically, the requirement that everybody who, unless you qualify for exception, that everybody has to sign up for some form of qualified coverage, or there's, you know, a financial penalty.
Right.
The second is the pre-existing condition, you know, denial, removal, guaranteed issue. That is, that the insurance companies, basically, you're metaphorically holding a gun to the insurance company's head and saying, you have to accept everyone. Regardless of, you know, whether they have cancer or, you know, you can't even ask if they have cancer, diabetes, whatever. You have to take everyone.
Right.
And you're holding another gun to the head of the enrollee and saying, you have to sign up. And the third leg is the subsidies, which is saying, okay, you have to offer it, you know, and accept these people. You have to sign up for this product. But if you can't afford it, or if you're, you know, if your income is too low to afford it, then we're going to help you out by providing financial subsidies. So those are the sort of the three main legs of the thing. And if you take away any one of those three, then the whole thing collapses. And, I mean, I would personally add a fourth leg, which is sort of a mishmash of things like the limited time period, you know, the time window, the open enrollment period that we're in the middle of right now, where you have a deadline, because that helps prevent people from gaming the system by, for example, not signing up for months and months and then waiting until they're actually sick, you know, they're diagnosed or they're hit by a car or whatever, and then all of a sudden saying, I want to sign up, because that causes massive rate hikes, because you're basically having somebody who's only paying for a couple of months of coverage, but they're getting, you know, huge, huge amounts of services in that window of time.
Which, again, is something the insurance companies insisted on.
Exactly. Exactly. And the thing, you know, the funny thing is about the limited time window, that's common practice in most, you know, large corporations, you know, where they have, you know, open enrollment. That's common practice in Medicare every year. You know, it's open enrollment for Medicare,
sure,
where it's a
sure
limited time window. And it's actually usually much shorter than it is for the ACA.
Right. But to ask about how that's going to affect individual people, because this is a question that I've seen online and interact with folks on, and I don't know the answer to it. Let's say that in whatever their repeal and replace nonsense, this happens. They keep the sign-up window, but they defund a lot of the Medicaid thing, and a lot of people outside of the sign-up window lose their health insurance.
Right.
If the sign-up window still exists, would people be able to sign up for insurance at that point, or under what the current laws are? What happens to people who lose their insurance? Would they be able to immediately sign up for something else, or would they have to wait for the window?
No, under the current system, under the ACA, you basically have a three-month window, which we're in the middle of right now, where anyone can sign up during that three-month period. We have until the end of January. If the current law was kept as is, when you're out for the other 9 months of the year, there are situations where people are still signing up during the off-season as well. There's around 8,000 or 9,000 people a day who were signing up over the past year during the off-season nationally. And those are what are called special enrollment periods. And there's a list of circumstances that allow for that. So, for example, if you get married, you know, let's say that you have coverage and your fiance doesn't, and they get married, then you can, you know, you can go in and you can add them to, you know, your policy. If you have a child, you know, obviously you can't sign up a kid before they're born, because they, you know, they're not a kid yet. So,
right.
So if you give birth, or if you adopt a child, if you are a young adult who's on your parents' employer sponsored plan, you know, the ACA allows 19 to 25 year olds to stay on their parents' plan. And most of those people are through employer coverage. Well, let's say you turn 26 during the off season. Now you are kicked off of your parents' plan. So now, you know, you have to find your own. And so, yeah, you're allowed to sign up then. So there's a whole bunch of reasons, but the most common one is what you just said, which is if you lose your existing coverage for reasons that are not under your control. So for example, if you lose your job, and you lose your coverage that way, or if you get divorced during the off season and you were on your spouse's plan, and so now you're off on your own, that sort of thing. So that's what I think, something like 3/4, I'd say, of the people who sign up during the off season, that's the main reason, is that they've had a major life change, they've lost their coverage, or they move. That's the other big one, is if you move from state to state, or even from part of one state to another part of the same state, a lot of the policies are only good in certain parts of the state. So, you know, you might lose your existing policy. And so that allows you to sign up at any time. So there are a smaller number of people who sign up during the off season, but the main point is to get everyone to sign up during this limited time window.
Okay. So assuming that a lot of this is left in place and that system is left in place, if people lose Medicaid, that might be an option. It's just, we don't know what they're going to do.
Well, yes and no, but here's the other problem with that. And again, we're assuming that, you know, everything else except for that stays in place, which
probably
won't happen, but even if that were to happen, the problem is that now you get into the Medicaid gap and the subsidy gap, which is the ACA, under the law now, it provides federal financial subsidies for people who sign up for private coverage through the exchange if their income falls between 100 and 400% of the federal poverty line. If you're below that threshold, you do not qualify for federal subsidies, because at the law was originally written, it was on the assumption that all those folks would be on Medicaid because the law expanded Medicaid. But if you pick them off of Medicaid, let's say that you're at, you know, 90% of the federal poverty level, but your state didn't expand Medicaid, then all of a sudden you're caught in the middle where you earn too much for Medicaid, or if you're an adult without kids, in many states you may not matter what your income is. So you don't qualify for Medicaid, but you also earn too little, oddly enough, qualify for subsidies because you're below that 100% threshold. This is already a problem for several million people in the 19 states which did not expand Medicaid. I think there's 2 or 3 million people who are already caught in that, where they're basically out of luck now. But that would be worse if they were to yank away the Medicaid expansion part of the ACA, but keep everything else exactly as is, because there are other states where, unless they expanded their Medicaid threshold within the state to that 100% level, then those people would be in trouble as well.
So there's no easy answers then for people about what might happen at this stage then.
Well, the thing is that it was designed as with certain, there were several pieces of the puzzle of the ACA that were put together, and they were put together in a certain way. And if you take out any one of those pieces, it tends to cause, you know, again, the three-legged stool. Maybe Jenga is a better.
I was just going to say it's healthcare Jenga.
Yeah, and it's. I know that's not a flattering way of putting it, but this goes back to more philosophical. This goes back to our old single payer, you know, discussion we had last year or earlier in the year, which is that the ACA is very complex, but there are reasons for that, and the main reason for that is that you didn't have a clean slate to start out with. You know, this goes in the whole single payer versus
right.
Is that you already had a very complex system, and the ACA was designed for all the fuss about, oh, it's disrupting, it's very disruptive. The reality is it's actually the least disruptive way that they could find politically and logistically and financially and in all these other ways. It was actually one of the least disruptive ways, because one of the main goals was not just to disrupt the employer-based market as much as possible. You have half the country roughly covered by employer coverage. You have another, you know, other big chunks covered by Medicare and Medicaid. And, you know, then you had this window of around 50 million people who were uninsured, and their best option really was either put them in Medicaid through expansion or add them to the individual market, which was already the smallest sliver of the pie to begin with. You know, there were about, in 2013, you know, just before the exchanges kicked in, there were around 10 or 11 million people in the individual exchange. And that's where the other half, you know, half the focus was on Medicaid expansion. The other half was mainly on the individual market. And so as disruptive as it may have been, it actually was disruptive to only maybe about 4 or 5 million people directly. Whereas if you were to go with single payer or something like that, then you're disrupting all 320 million people all in one shot. We talked about that, you know, earlier.
So I own a small manufacturing company, and what we did was we had been carrying employer health care for our employees prior to the ACA, and we had paid 70% and the employees paid 30%, which is a pretty common, you know, thing that small businesses just have to do because we couldn't afford to carry 100% of it. Right. And when the ACA came along, I got online and did a massive amount of calculations and spent about 2 months working it out and figured out that if we dropped, because we have fewer than 100 employees, so we could do this. If we dropped healthcare for our employees and then paid everyone a recommended healthcare bonus, and we targeted that at the mid-range cost of a silver plan for each employee, and we pay 100% of that. and they receive that plus a little bit extra to cover the tax implications and all of that in their checks every pay period. Mm-hmm. So most of them chose to use that on health insurance. Some of them didn't. That's their right, and you know, that's their personal decision. But the net of all that was that for us as a small business, it saved me about $50,000 a year, which for me is a lot of money. So what we did just 2 weeks ago in the midst of all of this is that we put out a 2-page memo to our employees, and we said, hey folks, we're coming up on we're in the ACA signup period. So if you're going to sign up for 2017, make sure to do that. And we, reminded them of the mechanism and everything to do that, and reminded them that their 2017 recommended health insurance bonus would still be in their checks and everything. But then we told them, because the Trump administration plans to get rid of the ACA, we think this is the last year we're going to be able to afford health insurance for you at all. We think that the cost of employer health care is going to be so much greater in 2018 that, we just can't even figure out how we could wrap our heads around that. So my intention was not to scare them miscellaneously, but I think insurance companies in 2018 I think it's going to be a mess. And I think they're going to take all of those pre-existing conditions that fall into their pools now, and prices are going to go up. People complain because prices went up inside the ACA. Mm-hmm. And by the way, so did subsidies. But prices went up inside the ACA programs this year, just like they do in insurance out in the open market every year.
Right.
But people complained. And I think it's going to be much, much greater than that in 2018. What's your projection?
Yeah, well, that goes back to the whole partial repeal versus full repeal and all that. But you just touched on the latest twist, which is, so the Republicans, they, as you said, they have, they're sort of caught between a rock and a hard place. Now that they actually are, they're the dog that caught the car or whatever you want to call it. Now that they're in a position to actually go ahead and kill the law, they want to repeal the ACA in a splashy way so that they can look to their base and say, see, we've been promising for 6 years we were going to kill it, and we did it. And they want to do that right away. The problem is, or there's many problems, but one of the main problems is that they also don't want to be blamed for millions of people losing their coverage, which is what would happen if they were to repeal it. Well, there's two things. First of all, they don't have a replacement plan. They have a bunch of different partial plans and sort of plans and this and that, bits and pieces. But they don't have a full comprehensive plan ready to, written into like in a legal bill way. It hasn't been scored by the CBO or anything like that. So they do not have a full replacement ready to go to slip in and, to swap out one for the other anyway, even if that's, what they wanted. But the other thing is that basically there's going to be a lot of disruption, like I said, far more than there would be, than there was under the ACA itself, which was phased in, over time. They claim that now that they want to bump that out, they're going to repeal it now and then replace it 2 or 3 or even 4, I hear now, even up to 4 years from now. Basically, they want to push it out past the midterms and so on. And supposedly, they're going to allow for a smooth, gradual transition where people who are on the exchange policies now would be given a couple of years and, be slowly phased out, which sounds good on the surface. But the problem is, from the insurance carrier's point of view, and I am no friend of private, profit-based insurance companies, but you still have to look at it from their perspective. They have just spent the last 6 years, like I said, completely overhauling their entire system, uprooting and overturning, and, it's been very, it's been messy, but they've completely overhauled their entire system. And most of them have been losing money on the exchanges, as you've heard all this year. And so some of them have been more patient than others. And, there are some that have been sticking it out for several years because they realize that when the dust settles, when the ACA market does stabilize, which takes a few years, that they saw profits at the end of that. It may be down the light at the end of the tunnel. They saw profits coming at some point, and some of them were more willing to, take their time and buy their time for that than others. And this past year, some of the bigger ones like United Healthcare and Humana and Aetna decided, we're going to pull out of most of the markets because they lost their patients. But there are others that have been actually making money all along, or at least more. Right, Anthem. Some have been breaking even. Some have been making money. I know Florida Blue in Florida has been making a profit. Centene has been doing pretty well. Molina has been doing well. So, again, there are winners and losers in any market. And some have basically, if they position themselves properly or they, you know, whatever, some did better than others. And so some are doing fine. And there are several that, like, just the last week, I believe, or a week or two ago, Blue Cross of North Carolina, which had been complaining about losing hundreds of millions of dollars on the exchanges. Well, they reported that for the first three quarters of this year anyway, they actually made a decent profit on the exchanges. Now, that may not, when you add the fourth quarter in and so forth, they may end up not making a profit. But it sounds like they're going to at least break even, which is a lot better, you know. And so basically they're on the path for profitability. And I ironically suspect that this last big, you know, price jump that we're seeing right now,
right,
that it really was sort of a one-time over the hump sort of thing. And that I think that a lot of the carriers were expecting to at least break even next, you know, this coming year, and then hopefully make a profit after that. So that's where they were thinking things were going, was, aha, we've gone through all this and we're finally, well, now they're being told, oh, we're good. Now the Republicans are going to come in, they're going to rip all this away, and they're going to have a replacement, but the replacement, you know, plan isn't going to go into effect for 2 or 3 or 4 years down the road. A lot of them, if I was a CEO of, you know, one of these carriers, I'd be like, you know what, screw this, I'm out of here, you know?
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, basically say, I'm tired of this, I'm going home now, you know? And that is the prediction. That's not just me saying that, like, every actuary, I mean, the American Society of Actuaries or Academy of Actuaries, whatever, they sent an open letter to Congress just last week urging, you know, basically saying, if you do this way, if you repeal the law without a replacement ready to go right away, that, you know, a decent replacement, that we suspect that the vast majority of the carriers that are still on the exchanges are going to bail. And they're not going to wait 2 or 3 years to bail. Many of them are probably going to get up and walk, you know, next year. Now they're all committed for 2017, but this time next fall, that you're probably going to see, you know, I don't know, maybe like 90% of them, maybe all of them, I don't know, but that a substantial number of them that have stuck it out this long are going to say, you know what, I don't need this, I'm out of here. And the reason they can do that so easily is that most of these carriers, again, the individual market is, while you're talking, you know, millions of people, 10, 20, the actual individual market is around 20 to 22 million people. That sounds like a lot of people, and it is, but that's still only a tiny fraction of most of their business, because most of that is either employer-sponsored, you know, group coverage, large or small, you know, like your business as a small group, or, you know, major employers with tens of thousands of employees, or in many cases, it's managed Medicare or managed Medicaid, you know. And so that's like, you know, that's something like 80% of the country, you know, that's where they're most of their bread and butter is. So the individual market is, to them, to most of these carriers, is really, it's more of a headache for them. They'd like to make money at it, but if they can't make money, and they also, if they don't think they're going to make any money, and it's a big headache to deal with, because first it's the ACA, and now we're ripping away the ACA, and, you know, now it's Trump Care, it's just changing every few years. From that perspective, you know, why do they, you know, they don't need this, you know?
Right.
It's one division of their business. And so they might cut their losses. And that's exactly what you saw happen. The funny thing is that the major carriers that bailed this year, you know, again, United Healthcare, Aetna, and Humana, they have very little experience with the individual market. Most of their business is and experiences with the group, you know, group market. The ones that have been making money, like I said, Molina, Centene, and Florida Blue and so forth, most of those carriers, most of their experience has been with managed Medicaid. So they had more experience with more handholding and more with more churn in the market and that sort of thing, which is common in Medicaid as opposed to the group market, where it tends to be more stable. You tend to have people who are there for years or decades in a row, and where there's less churn involved. But yeah, any carrier that thinks this is going to be more of a headache than it's worth, if they're not guaranteed or reasonably sure that they're going to make a few bucks in this market sooner or later, they're likely going to bail. And all this, you know, all this is causing with the Republicans with this repeal now and replace later and all that is uncertainty. And that's the last thing in the world that insurance actuaries like, is uncertainty. You know?
That's the last thing in the world any business can't live with. I mean, I don't know a business that flourishes in uncertainty except, I don't know, casinos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point. And you know, this kind of goes into the larger philosophical point about, you know, like taxes, you know, where Republicans are always saying, you know, well, slash taxes, cut corporate taxes, and, you know, and they'll bring their factories here and the jobs will flow. Again, in certain circumstances, maybe, but as a small business owner myself, I mean, I don't have any employees. It's mainly just me. But what you want is stability. Is you want to, you know, I would rather, if I'm deciding, well, do I want to move my business to a place where there's a 20% tax, or do I want to move to a place where it's 10%, but then it's 15%, but then it's 9%, but then it's 40%, you know, where it's jumping all over the place. You know, you're usually going to want to go with something where it's stable, even if that stability is higher. You know,
yeah.
At least you can account for it. You can
plan. Plan's the word you're looking for.
Yes. So yeah, but yeah, in insurance, especially in particular health insurance, that's even more the case. Stability and continuity of care. You know, that's not just true on the enrollee side, where that's a main concern, but it's also on the insurance, you know, on the business side, from the insurance company's point of view, is they want to know where things stand from year to year and month to month and so on as much as possible. And all this is doing is just screwing it all up again.
We have to bring it to a close there for this segment of the interview. You've been listening to us on Netroots Radio. You can find Hopping Mad at I'm Hopping Mad on Twitter. You can listen to the show on Stitcher, Google Play, and iTunes. And Charles, we just really want to thank you for being with us here today. For those of you listening to the podcast, we'll be right back. Next up is K-Grow in the Morning here on Netroots Radio. We're back on Hopping Mad in the extra mad part of the interview with Charles Gaba, Brain Wrap. And Charles, you posted something that got a lot of interest yesterday in reference to a New York Times article. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So yesterday morning, the New York Times, I think it was yesterday, the New York Times, they ran an article about it was written by Robert Pear and Thomas Kaplan. Called GOP plans to replace healthcare law with, quote, universal access, unquote. And it, they've been having a lot of controversy and confusion about, okay, they're going to get rid of the ACA, but what are they going to replace it with? And so this talks a little bit about that, but the main focus from the Republicans' point of view is that what they're trying to do is they're trying to do a little wordsmithing here where, you know, most progressives and Democrats talk about providing universal coverage, and usually they're talking about in terms of, you know, a single payer or whatever. You know, that's sort of like, you know, the Bernie Sanders, you know, controversy and a lot of single payer advocates. But even whether it's single payer or not, that's just a payment mechanism. The main point is that make sure that everybody in the country, or as many people in the country as possible, are covered by some form of quality, hopefully. Equality and hopefully comprehensive healthcare coverage. So the Republicans are trying to sort of piggyback on that by saying, well, instead of universal coverage, we're going to go with universal access. And there was a quote in there that caught my eye where it says that there's an unnamed Republican aide who's quoted as saying, quote, we would like to get to a point where we have what we call universal access, where everybody is able to access coverage to some degree or another, the aide said. And it was that to some degree or another part that really caught my eye, because if you look at what they're talking about doing, or the main parts of what they're talking about doing, and that changes from day to day and moment to moment, but for the most part, what they're talking about doing are a couple of main things. One is when it comes to the high-risk, what was called a high-risk pool. Republicans want to keep, or they say that they want to keep, the part of the ACA that prevents insurance carriers from denying coverage based on pre-existing conditions, right? That's the part that everybody loves. However, the pre-existing conditions clause, that's also the part that causes the bulk of the price increases, the premium increases and deductible increases that we've seen over the past few years. The bulk of that comes from the fact that the carriers now have to cover, that they can't cherry pick anymore, that they have to take everyone, and so that means that there are millions of people who have cancer, diabetes, you know, and so forth. There's a long list of other expensive pre-existing conditions that people have that they need treatment for, that are very, very expensive. And so if you put all those people in to the individual market pool, which wasn't that big to begin with, that tends to spike costs, you know, because that's the whole point of shared risk. That's the whole point of insurance, is that you spread the risk. That's what a risk pool is. So the Republican plan is, well, the way that used to be handled before the ACA was that the insurance companies could simply not insure those people. And hey, look at that. They keep prices low because they aren't covering these people with these really expensive conditions. Now they have to, and they say that they want to keep that because that's very, you know, that's a very popular provision of the Affordable Care Act. So how do they keep the prices low? Well, one of the main ways that their plans they're talking about doing is to shunt all of those people with those expensive conditions over into what's called a high-risk pool. Basically, they separate them out again, and they cover them, but they cover them in a whole separate risk pool, and that way it lowers the prices for everybody else.
But doesn't that undermine the entire purpose of a you know, broad-based risk pool, to have separate risk?
Yes, exactly. It makes prices lower for Group A, but it makes prices much, much more expensive for Group B, because Group B is all the people with leukemia and cancer, you know, and diabetes and so forth. So what they plan on doing, depending on whose plan you go with, and again, there's a bunch of them, but the main ones that have been getting attention are Paul Ryan's plan. I think he calls it A Better Way. And then one by Tom Price, who is a congressman, and he's Trump's pick for HHS director, right? Or HHS secretary.
Right.
And the funding of those high-risk pools, depending on which plan you go with, is supposedly going to be between either $1 billion per year, according to Price's plan, or $2.5 billion per year, well, $25 billion over 10 years, so about $2.5 billion per year under Ryan's plan, to cover those people in the high-risk pool. Well, that sounds pretty generous, except that the actual cost of covering the majority, not even all, but the majority, according to a 2014 Commonwealth Fund report, covering the majority of uninsured Americans with pre-existing conditions through a national high-risk pool would cost an estimated $178 billion per year. And that was in 2014. I presume it's gone up a little more since then. The point is that you're talking about just covering a tiny fraction of the cost. Well, guess what? Before the ACA, there were a number of states that had their own high-risk pools at the state level. And that was, for the most part, a disaster, because they were severely underfunded even then. And there was and I quote in this piece that I wrote yesterday, there was a Kaiser Family Foundation report from before the ACA, where they talk about the high-risk pools at the state level. And again, the premiums were through the roof. They were up to double what it is for the rest of the individual market even then. And even then, they were still severely underfunded. A lot of them did not require the enrollees to pay the full premium. There were no deductibles, you know, there was no financial assistance whatsoever. And ironically, even in the high-risk pools, which were set up specifically for people with pre-existing conditions, a lot of times they still had denials of people with pre-existing conditions from enrolling for up to a year. So if you have cancer and you are denied coverage from the individual market under the pre-ACA rules, you would say, oh, well, at least I can go to this high-risk pool. I'll have to pay a fortune, but at least I'll be treated. Well, in a lot of cases, they still denied you coverage for 6 months to a year in an attempt to keep the prices down.
Because people might die within 6 months to a year.
Well, yeah, you die and then, hey, you know, you come to zero. You know? So, yeah, and in fact, a lot of the states would cap. They would have a set number. You know, once they hit, it was a first-come, first-served thing. Once you hit a cap, a ceiling on how many you enrolled, they cut you off. Nobody else could enroll. So, no, it was a disaster.
And that was the death panels thing, right? Where the Republicans were saying, if you have Obamacare, you'll have death panels. And we were like, no, you won't. But we didn't realize that the Republicans were saying, we're going to set up death panels.
Exactly. And so this, all they're talking about doing is the exact same thing, just doing it at the federal level. So that instead of having a state-based disaster, they have a federal-based disaster. So that's number one. But the other part of it, and this is where sort of some degree or another, the other part of that is when it comes to the actual policies which would be offered on the exchanges or whatever they replace the exchanges with. Maybe they'll keep them, maybe they won't. Which is that right now under the ACA, part of the other main reason why those the policies on the ACA, why the rates have gone up to whatever degree they have, is that they also require those policies to be real comprehensive coverage. That's the comprehensive part. That is that they actually cover stuff.
Right.
There's a list of there are 10 essential benefits, they're called, that have to be covered by every single plan, which includes things like emergency service, hospitalization, surgery, overnight stays at the hospital, pregnancy and maternity, prescription drugs have to be covered, lab services have to be covered. These are standard stuff that you would assume would be covered by a health insurance policy, right? All those things have to be covered by every single plan. Even the low-end bronze ones or the high-end platinum ones, they all have to cover at least this stuff. And then there's some optional things like dental and, other things that could be added as well. But there's these sort of core things that have to be included with every single plan. In other words, they have to be true healthcare policies. There's also a long list, there's like 20, 30 of them, of various preventative care services that have to be covered at no charge for the enrollee. Like blood pressure screening and treatment for mammograms and things like that. They have to be covered at no charge. So there's a lot of stuff which you don't have to pay anything out of pocket for under the ACA. So that means that your deductible, you can't be charged, off your deductible, for example. So these are, these are fairly robust policies. Maybe you're paying more, but you're getting a whole lot more. And one of the main things that the Republican plans seem, and again, this could change, but that they seem to be suggesting is that they would strip away most or all of those regulations, which means going back to the days of what are called mini-meds. And that was something that a lot of people signed up for before the ACA, where there were basically these bare bones, minimalist coverage that were essentially ripoffs in most cases. And I found a description of them from, this is going back, I think it was 2012, from the Kaiser Family Foundation, where they said, for example, McDonald's offered, they required, before the ACA, they required employees to pay $56 per month for basic coverage that provides up to $2,000 per year in benefits. Okay. Well,
math being a key here.
$56 a year is pretty, that's pretty reasonable. $2,000 in benefits per year is pointless when it comes to healthcare, because that's basically the cost of like one day in the hospital, or maybe the cost of the ambulance ride to get to the hospital. It's a joke.
This last weekend, I had an absolutely traumatic rabbit health emergency that took me out of town to a major veterinary center, a place with, CT scanners and MRIs and, hardcore major veterinary hospital. $3,000 later. That insurance doesn't even cover my rabbit, let alone a human being.
Yeah. And these used to be called mini meds, or they were commonly known as junk policies. And don't get me wrong, there are some rare circumstances where they might make sense, for a specific person under specific circumstances. But what they basically amount to in many cases is discount coupons. They're basically, knock $50 off of your, $5,000 bills, whatever. The other part they talked about is that one of the other major provisions of the ACA, which again doesn't get a lot of attention, is that a lot of these mini meds or a lot of these policies for the ACA had fairly stingy annual caps or lifetime caps that on their claims. That is, so there might be a yearly cap of say $100,000 per year for and once you got past that, then they didn't cover anything else. Well, again, that sounds like a lot of money. And if you don't have cancer or something, or don't come down, you know, don't end up in a full body traction from getting hit by a car or something, where you're in a full body cast for, you know, for months or whatever, then that might be reasonable. But the problem is that there's a lot of people, especially in the high risk end, you know, the pre-existing condition end, who have ailments which can cost, you know, $1 million per year. And, you know, they'll die because they'll just be able to cut off the treatment and, you know, then they die. So they want to go back to that. So basically they want to strip away all the regulations. So yeah, the cost of the policies, quote unquote, you know, may go down, but even if they do, it's going down because there's nothing covered or very little covered. So that's what they're trying to get away with here, essentially, is to strip away all the regulations, say they don't have to cover much of anything. Hey, look, we cut your premiums down. And you're basically right back where you started in a sucky system, except that now it's been federalized. I posted an article about that the key takeaway is not universal access, which is what they're trying to push. The key phrase to remember is to some degree or another. You know,
exactly.
That's what they mean by that.
How many children will lose health care?
Oh, that's, you know what, I don't have that. There were a couple reports about that the other day. I'm sorry,
I should have warned. I know it's...
I mean, I can tell you how many people overall.
Okay, let's start there.
Hold on a second here. So, or at least I can give you a pretty good idea. There's a couple of estimates. I came up with my own state-by-state breakdown analysis thing, and right around the same time I was working on that, it turned out that the Urban Institute, which is, you know, has a lot more people with a lot more experience and a lot better funding than I do, they were actually working on their own estimate, and I kind of wish that I had known that before I did mine, but it would have saved me the trouble. But we actually approached it from slightly different angles anyway. So I came up with a rough estimate of around 23 million people who would lose their current coverage, their current, whether it's through Medicaid or private plans, would lose their or would likely lose their current healthcare coverage, policy, what have you, under a full repeal of the ACA with immediate effect and no replacement. Now, that's not likely to happen, especially the immediate effect part for some of it. But if that were to happen, where it was just completely repealed, completely cut off instantly, you know, basically this coming spring, I come up with around 23 million people, looking at around 12.3 million were on Medicaid, exclusively due to the law itself, that is, to the expansion of eligibility, and then plus about another... I'm estimating around another 9 million people on the individual market, which would basically be those who are expected to receive, who are enrolled through the exchanges and are receiving significant subsidies. It's not everyone, because there are some people at the high income end who they're enrolled, but they're not receiving, you know, but they're paying full price anyway, and or they're only receiving a nominal, you know, subsidy, where it'd be more of an annoyance to lose it than, you know, a serious impact. But I figure there's around 9 million people nationally who simply would not be able to afford a private policy without those subsidies attached to it. And then on top of that, you add, and this one is a little more questionable, I estimate around 1.4 million young adults who are on their parents' policy specifically due to ACA provisions. That number is a lot more questionable because there's a lot of fuzziness about exactly how many people are, how many of those are enrolled and how many of them are specifically due to the ACA, because there are a lot of states which actually have similar laws at the state level before the ACA anyway. And the ages ranged, you know, some of it was like 22, some was 25. Some of it was only if they're married, only if they're not married, or only if they're students, and so on. So it's kind of fuzzy, but But yeah, so I figure a minimum of 22 million, possibly 23 million people who would have their would either not simply not be able to afford their current policies, or would simply be kicked off in the case of Medicaid. The Urban Institute, they came up with an estimate even higher under a partial expansion. A partial repeal. And this goes back to what I was talking about at the beginning of the hour of the show, which is that due to the weird way in which insurance and risk pools and all that works, it would actually be even worse to have a partial repeal. That is, it would be even worse to take away one of those legs of the stool than all of them, which would be bad enough. Because if you do a partial repeal, but you keep the pre-existing condition clause, for example, and the community rating clause, which prevents carriers from ranging the prices too much, for younger people versus older people and all that, you're taking away all the good stuff, but keeping all the parts that make rates go up. Not only would it decimate everybody I just talked about, but it would also completely destroy the off-exchange individual market, which is that there's around 20 million to 22 million people in the individual market total. About half of those are on the exchange, right? 11, 12 million people. The other half, 40%, whatever, about the other 8 or 9 million people are off the exchange. That is, there's people who are buying the same policies, but they're buying them directly through the insurance company, not through healthcare.gov or whatever. So they're paying full price. These are higher income people who are paying full price for the most part for their policies. And there's about maybe 8 million of those. Well, their rates would skyrocket as well, because there would still be the pre-existing conditions and so forth, but there wouldn't be the subsidies, and there also wouldn't be the individual mandate. So you'd have a much higher risk pool, so the rates would skyrocket even further. And those people paying full price, these people may have a higher income, but it's not going to be that much higher for most of them to be able to afford, these massive, massive rate hikes, especially at full price. So the Urban Institute estimated that most of those people would probably drop off the market as well. And that's around another 6 or 7 million people. So they estimate that it could be as high as 30 million people nationally.
Wow.
And I break it out by state and all that on the site. I have a post pinned at the top of the site where I go into all that. But the bottom line is you're talking about, like 8 or 9% of the country.
Well, fortunately, we can feel confident that none of those people voted for Donald Trump.
Oh, you were serious.
No, not at all.
No,
totally actually, facetious.
Paul Krugman at the New York Times, he actually asked a question a couple weeks ago. He asked the very question of how many of these people, how many Trump voters, how many of these people just voted to rip away their own coverage. And he came up with sort of a rough, back of the envelope math figure. He came in the figure based on this and that and the other. He thought it was maybe around 4 million or so. When I did my analysis, I and again, this is very rough, but I estimated it could be as high as 9 million, although probably that might be pushing it, based on, which states these people live in and what percentage of those voters went for Trump and, that sort of thing. But yeah, it sounds to me like it's somewhere in the 4 to 9 million range. Figure maybe 5 or 6 million people is probably a pretty good guess.
But people who voted for Trump and then are going to lose their health insurance as a result of that, they're not going to complain or anything. At least we're not going to have to listen to them complain, right?
Oh boy. So there was a county, there's a county in Kentucky, Clay County, Kentucky. You may have read about this came up a couple weeks ago, where this is like one of the poorest counties in the state of Kentucky, which is one of the poorest states in the country, and it's a very, very low income average county, where let's see here, 86%, 60%, they have 21,000 people who live there, so it's a pretty small, low population. 60% of Clay County's residents are covered by Medicaid, up from about a third before the expansion. So they have 21,000 people. Before the ACA expansion, about 7,000 of them were on Medicaid, and now it's something like 13,000 or something like that. Basically 60% of the county is covered by Medicaid. 87% of Clay County voters voted for Donald Trump. And, yeah. So, Sarah Cliff, after this came out, about a week later, Sarah Cliff of Vox, you know, the health reporter, she visited, I think she visited, I'm not sure if she went there in person, I think she did.
Yeah, she did. I heard her interviewed. She went there in person.
Okay. She went down to Clay County and she interviewed a bunch of these people and asked them, you know, what's the deal? And, it was a long story. You said you listened to the interview. But the bottom line, that the two main things that I got from that was, one was that there seemed to be two groups of these people. They're split into two major factions. One was there were a bunch of them who simply didn't believe that, let me back up. There was one group who were confused because they didn't know that their coverage was due to Obamacare, through the Affordable Care Act. And this goes into the whole thing about labeling and branding and Connect. Remember, when they were the Matt Bevin, their new governor that they just elected last year, he campaigned on a platform of getting rid of Obamacare, hurting Obamacare in Kentucky, but at the same time, they loved Connect. Their poll after poll showed that everybody loved the Connect system and they loved their Medicaid and they were so thrilled with all of it, but they hated that Obamacare. And, they did not understand that they're the same thing, that the reason they have Medicaid is because of the Affordable Care Act, AKA Obamacare. And they loved their policy that they got through Connect because, it only cost me, $80 a month or whatever, and that's a bargain, and I get, decent coverage, and thank God for Connect. And, well, that's Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, and they don't understand. So that was the one group, and that's very infuriating for obvious reasons. But the other half was even more infuriating, which is there were people who they know damn well that the only reason they have their healthcare coverage that they have, which they really love, they love to have, and it's literally a lifesaver for many of them, but they simply didn't believe, or they don't believe, that the Republicans and Donald Trump will take it away. And there was a quote for one of them in the article where one of them specifically was quoted as saying, "How can they take it away when so many people like me rely on it?"
I know.
Because they can't. Because how could they? Even though that's specifically what they've been campaigning on for 6 years now.
Yeah, I actually threw up in my mouth a little when I read that. I mean, I feel a little ill when I realize how badly Democrats have run against that. I mean, it seems like we can't manage to brand our way or explain our way out of a brown paper bag. It's freaking amazing to me.
Well, it's even, it's even worse than that in a way, because here's the thing. They may end up being right to some degree because of Democrats and people like me and you stressing millions and millions of people will lose their coverage if you do this, And so they may back off, just like in, just like 10 years ago or 12 years ago when they were trying to privatize Social Security, and there was a massive backlash by Democrats, and so they said, okay, we'll leave it alone, and they didn't. And did the Democrats give any thanks for that? No. So they may end up being right that they won't take it away, but not because they're not trying to. They, only because of the backlash from the Democrats, the very people they voted, that these people voted against. And it reminds me, this is a strange segue, but remember, you ever seen the TV show, there's an animated show, Avatar, The Last Airbender?
No,
I haven't.
Well, you've seen it?
Yeah, I have. I've seen it.
Okay, they made a terrible movie out of, a live-action movie out of it, but the TV series was actually awesome. Very good. And the details don't matter, but there was one episode where there's this group of, it's a kid and his companions, and they're traveling around the countryside, going from village to village and so forth. And they go to this remote village where it's a village at the foot of an active volcano, right? And there's this fortune teller who is very respected. She's esteemed and respected, and every prediction she says, everybody believes in the village. So they come into this village and they see that this volcano is about to erupt and it's going to destroy the village. And so they're like telling people, you got to get the hell out of the way because, you know, you're all going to die. And the villagers, they don't care because they're saying, no, we'll be fine because the fortune teller, she predicted that when the volcano erupts, that we'll all be fine. You know, that it won't destroy the village. Everybody will be okay. I'm sure I'm mangling the story, but this is how I remember it. And so they go to see the fortune teller, and it turns out she has no magic. You know, she's a sham. She's a con artist. You know, she's just making stuff up. None of her predictions are accurate. You know, it's just, she's just a complete con artist. And so they're like, you know, so the volcano erupts. And so so this group of the main characters, they're like, we have to take care of this. So they themselves engineer, they go into all this engineering where they arrange for for the lava to flow, you know, into it. They build a channel, you know, outside the village. And they go through all this tremendous work to save the village, to prevent everybody from dying. And they instruct the villagers. They say, you've got to do this. Here's what you do. You know, move this boulder and so forth. And it works. And, that, you know, the lava flows and the village is saved. And afterwards, they go up to the villagers and they're like, okay, will you now believe us that she was full of crap? And they say, well, no, she was right. See, none of us died.
That's right. Yeah.
Same. She was right. We did, you know, we did all survive. And it's like, yeah, because we happened to show up and, you know, save bail your asses out. So it's very frustrating. So basically they still voted for the fortune teller. Even though she didn't want to do anything.
Great. You
know. Basically Donald Trump, the Republicans are saying you'll all be fine because the Democrats will save your butts.
Yeah, exactly. So speaking of the Democrats, the left talks about single payer as if it was a magic bullet. Don't get me wrong. I am pro single payer, but it's not a panacea by any means. Would you just tell us some of the problems that exist under single payer systems, just kind of to keep that in people's minds as we go through this nightmare we're about to go through?
Sure. So this is, you know, sort of going back to what we talked about earlier in the year. Again, I'm as I said then and now, I am generally in favor of a single payer or single payer like system. And it's really about the mechanics and the logistics and obviously the political side. But even without the politics, there's still a lot of economic and other issues that have to be taken into consideration. And, you know, a lot of it's just the getting from here to there part, which was what we mainly talked about, you know, last spring. Right. But even assuming you can wave a magic wand and get to single, you know, full single payer system, you do have to take into account a couple of things. One is, again, as we talked about before, is the impact on, you know, things like employment and such. There are several million people who work in the, you know, insurance industry, and what's going to happen to them if they all lose their job? You know, because you know, some of them presumably would go to work for the government, you know, to manage the single payer system, but most of them probably wouldn't. And that's part of, ironically, that's one of the reasons why single payer is supposed to be more, you know, cost effective, is because increased efficiency. You know, you don't need as many people to manage it. There's less paperwork and red tape and all that. Well, that's all good, except that you're also putting people out of work, and so, you know, you have to account for that. The other, you know, the other question is what, you know, one of the things that bothered me about Senator Sanders' plan, at least as it was originally presented, was that it supposedly would be 100% cover it, is that the plan would pay for everything. That is, that there would be no co-pays or deductibles. At least that was my interpretation of it. Maybe that was wrong. But even as a single payer advocate, you have to have some minimal co-pays or maybe not a deductible, but you have to have some buy-in by most people. Because otherwise what you could end up with is if everything's going to be paid for 100%, then, you'll have people who will go to the doctor for every, paper cut and so forth. And so on. So having some sort of a reasonable, and that's the thing is Medicare, it was supposedly called Medicare for All, except that Medicare actually does have premiums.
Right.
It does have some amount of skin in the game, as they call it, by the enrollees. And that's, that's one of the reasons why is that if absolutely everything is covered 100% for free, then there would be some amount of abuse of that. Now, that doesn't hold true at the lower income level, because if someone can't afford it, they can't afford it. And that's the reason why Medicaid, for the most part, there's very little or no, payment that has to be made by the enrollees in most cases. But once you do that, if you have some sort of a premium or whatever, then that means that there's money, there's money moving around. And so that does require some amount of additional management and overhead and so forth. And that's one of the things that actually, I believe, states like Indiana have found, because they tried to, they took the Medicaid expansion, but they did it through their own, kind of modified version. And it does include things like co-pays and premiums and such for people. And there's all these different like thresholds and different, there's version one and version two, and it gets very complicated and messy. So you have to find the sweet spot.
It isn't working here, but it isn't necessarily the worst idea ever. I just think that, as with all things like this, it takes time to find the sweet spot, and we're nowhere close to it in Indiana. It's still a complete disaster.
Right.
So people who have insurance under the ACA are basically about to get screwed, and people who are under Medicaid are going to be affected. We've covered that. You've covered that in great detail in this program, but everybody else is going to be okay, right? For instance, if you are on a private insurance plan and you need to go into an emergency room, you're not going to be affected, right?
Well, that depends.
And
it depends on
just
what else
to be
they
specific,
do.
That depends on how many people are in front of you in line at the emergency room?
Well, right. And I will say that the problem with that is that's sort of a too early to tell situation. The idea was, one of the arguments, in favor of the ACA, and this, in particular Medicaid expansion part of it, was that before the ACA, you had a lot of people who were uninsured, and so they would go into the emergency room for everything. In some cases, for valid reasons, in some cases not. And that there were long lines and very expensive and so on and so forth. And the idea was that if you make sure these people are covered, that they would be more likely to go see a doctor or go to, urgent care, or go see a doctor and get set up an appointment and so forth, as opposed to clogging up the emergency rooms and causing hospital costs to skyrocket. The early evidence from that since the ACA was implemented is sort of fuzzy. It's hard to say. There have been a couple of studies that have found that it has made a difference. There's been a couple, I believe, there's been a couple that have said that it hasn't made a difference. A lot of that is that a lot of the problem with that, and I've spoken to a couple of doctors about this, is that some of that is a learning curve, because there are people who have been uninsured for so long that even when they get enrolled in Medicaid, or in some cases even in a private, heavily subsidized private plan, let's say, they still, old habits are hard to break, and there's a lot of cases where they're still kind of just sort of not taking advantage of that, and instead they're So instead of making an appointment, even though they can and it won't cost them anything out of pocket now, they're still like waiting until a small sniffle turns into, you know, pneumonia or whatever, and or until a small cut gets infected before they go into the doctor or whatever. So there is still, you know, it sounds like it may take a few years for people sort of break that habit and sort of understand, oh, now I don't have to wait until I'm sick. Now I can actually call up the doctor and make an appointment and, you know, get a checkup and have a mammogram or, you know, that sort of thing. That may take a little more time, but again, the problem is that there are some policies that take longer for the effects to kick in than the politics allow, you know?
Well, I do think that having spent a great deal of time in hospitals over this last year and knowing that I will in the beginning of this next year, I was speaking to a hospital administrator 2 visits ago, and we happened to be talking about the ACA. And she said one of the things that their hospital has done to dramatically decrease the pressure on their emergency room is that they have worked hard to recruit. This is a rural area, and they have worked very, very hard to recruit new doctors into this area because with the ACA, the population that is feeding into the healthcare system here increased dramatically, and there wasn't the doctor base. There weren't enough doctors who were accepting new patients to be able to accommodate that glut. So the hospital has gone to all kinds of lengths, including facility and all kinds of things, to bring in more doctors. And for them, what that does is move the pressure off of their emergency room and certain kinds of costs embedded in emergency procedures and into, you know, more standardized care. And they feel like that is well worth the trade-off for them.
Yeah, and again, that once again, just like I said earlier, just as the insurance companies have completely overhauled and retooled and, you know, put in, you know, spent countless resources into overhauling everything for the ACA, same thing is true of hospitals. Like you just said, you know, they're hospitals that have gone through great effort and, you know, expense perhaps in some cases and so forth to, you know, change their system, their way of doing things to accommodate the ACA and so forth. And now they're talking about reversing all of that. And I guarantee you, if I was a hospital, you know, budget administrator, I'd be like, you know, tearing my hair out because, you know, we just went through all this way. Not, you know, what are they going to do? They're going to fire all those doctors? They're going to close all those facilities? You know, and because there's costs involved, you know, you can't just set it up today and then remove it tomorrow. You know, there are costs both ways, and there's resources both ways, and there's people gaining a job and then losing a job, and you know, so you're jerking people around. That's another factor.
Do you have any, is there any data on the potential economic impact there?
Oh, of repealing the law?
Yeah.
I don't specifically, I mean, I know there is, I don't have that specifically in front of me, but, you know, the health, you know, I can say healthcare as a whole is, I think it's something like 20% of the entire U.S. economy. So anytime you're making any, you know, and that was one of the complaints, you know, when the law was passed, was that, oh, you're disrupting a fifth of the nation's economy. And well, now you're doing it again. You know, so anytime you're making any sort of a change, a large change like this, it's going to have a severe impact. And, you know, the irony is, of course, the claim for 6 years now has been, oh, it's a job killer. It's a job killer. Well, no, actually, we've gained, 12 million, 13 million jobs or something like that since the ACA was passed. So obviously it is not a job killer. I mean, you know, the response that, well, we would have had 20 million, you know, so it cost us 8 million jobs. You know, you can claim that, but you can't prove that.
Well, and, really? Because how many jobs were created by the Bush administration?
Right, exactly. So it clearly has not done anything to hurt job growth, and it certainly appears to have, if anything, it appears to have helped it. But it certainly hasn't hurt it at all. It's the funny thing, and the other thing there is that now what they're claiming, and I think this was mentioned in either the article, the New York Times article, or a couple of others, where one of the things that they're talking about now is doing it piecemeal. Instead of doing one big, massive, you know, replacement bill, that they're going to do it in little chunks. But again, the problem with that is that, again, you get into the whole Jenga thing, is if you take out, there's some parts of it where you have to do it in large, you know, in large pieces as opposed to just small bits and pieces, because taking out one part can impact the other three or four or five, you know, parts.
Well, and insurance companies are just, they just aren't going to play. I mean, they're just going to take their toys and go.
Yeah. So yeah, it's they're playing a very dangerous game here. And this is also at the same time that there are going to be all sorts of other awful, terrible things and policies and stuff implemented in non-healthcare areas as well. And you know, there's a lot of things that they're talking about doing that are going to be very, very disruptive to a lot more people than were disrupted by, you know, by receiving the you know, the non-compliant policy 3 or 4 years ago.
Exactly. So for my last question, I want to wrap up by asking you to go completely off the subject of the ACA and into an absolutely priceless rant that you posted this week on the Electoral College and your 11 state scenario. And I would love for you to describe that to folks, because I found it to be the best summation of why the Electoral College is inappropriate in this day and age of anything I've read anywhere online.
Well, thank you. Sure. So yeah, I posted a little mostly off topic thing a couple weeks ago. This was after the election, and obviously right now, you know, on Monday, you know, the Electoral College is supposed to meet and vote, and of course there's all this panic and people freaking out trying to get, you know, the Trump electors to vote for anyone other than Trump. But yeah, so I wrote up a thing where I pointed out that, you know, there's been a lot of talk, of course, about the fact that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote nationally. At the time it was about 2 million, but now it's actually very close. It's around 2.8 million, almost 2.9 million votes nationally that she voted, that they voted for her over Trump, around something like 66 million to 63 million people. But of course, under the Electoral College rules, that doesn't matter because he won, you know, more electoral votes in those particular states, and it, specifically here in Michigan, and then Wisconsin and Pennsylvania were the three closest states. Where Donald Trump won those three states by about 11,000, 23,000, 44,000, respectively. That's around 78,000 people across three states. He won those states by that slim of a margin. As a result, he receives 306 electoral votes, and therefore, you know, if they vote for him, he becomes president. Well, so I did the math on the electoral votes in each state, and what I found is that the 11 largest states, California, obviously, but then, you know, Texas, New York, Florida, and then going down to New Jersey, if you take those 11 states, they have a combined total of 270 electoral votes, which is the bare minimum needed to become president. So I did the math, and what I found is that using this year's turnout as an example, I broke it out by individual state and how many voted for, you know, each in each state and everything. And what I found is that Hillary Clinton could theoretically have won as much as, what was it, 73% of the vote and still have lost presidency, because she would still lose the Electoral College. That is, if she had won those 11 states, and that, you know, that's not likely to happen because one of them is, you know, is Texas, for example. But if she had, she could have won 73% of the vote this year. If she had won the other 39 states, but lost those 11, Trump would have still won if he had won those 11 states. But I took it even further. I took the sort of theoretical, hypothetical, you know, ludicrous example. And let's suppose that theoretically every single U.S. citizen who is able to was registered to vote. It's about 230 million people across the country. Let's say all of us were registered. And let's say that one person in each of those 11 states voted, only one person, not a million, not 100,000, one. They had a turnout of one person in those 11 states. but they had 100% turnout in the other 49 states, or 39 states, right? Every single person in every other state voted, and every other single person in the other 39 states voted for, let's say, Hillary Clinton. And only those 11 people in the entire country voted for Trump, right? And it was one person in each of those 11 states. That would mean that Donald Trump would have received 11 votes, and Hillary Clinton would have received 105 million votes, and she still would have lost. She could have gotten like 99.9999% of the popular vote and still lost in the Electoral College.
And that is why we need to get rid of the Electoral College.
Well, let me say
again,
this.
Obviously, that's ridiculous, but it is under our current laws, under the current, you know, the electoral. If the electors in those 11 states voted according to their thing.
Let me say one thing, though, in potential defense of the Electoral College. Federalist Papers, number 68, Alexander Hamilton. He talked about having a group of people, men, of course, he said, meeting together to vet the results of the election, and, you know, talked about making sure that some foreign group would not bring a creature of their choosing to the highest magistracy of the United States. It talked about using this as the final line of defense against a demagogue or against a foreign agent. Mm-hmm. So what that means is this. This is the one situation in which the Electoral College could actually do their duty to prevent that from happening.
Yep.
What's happening Monday, which we'll know about on January 6th. Now, I'm not hopeful that they will. I'm not hopeful at all. I don't think they will. But if they do actually do their constitutional duty, then they will have gained me as a defender. Because this is the one circumstance which they exist to serve. To guarantee that someone like Trump never comes into office, who is Putin's puppet. So, let's see what happens. But I mean, what do you say to that as someone who's arguing?
Well, but and I agree with that. But at the same time, you know, the idea behind the Electoral College was supposed to be, if a demagogue, et cetera, were to win the popular vote, you know, if the roles were reversed, if Trump had won the popular vote and Hillary Clinton had won the electoral vote, that would be the situation where they were supposed to, where they existed to override the popular vote, because we cannot, you know, we simply cannot go with this crazy, horrible, terrible person. And that was the scenario they envisioned. I don't think they ever envisioned the opposite, or if they did, you're right. I mean, this is exactly the reason why they exist at all. But here's the thing. If it didn't exist at all, and all we had was the popular vote, and it had gone exactly the way that it had, then then Hillary Clinton would have won, and nobody would have said boo about it. Now, the one, you know, and I mentioned this in my piece, there are only two reasons to have the Electoral College that I can. There's a bunch of arguments, but there's only two that hold any water that I can think of. One is what you just said, the last line of defense in preventing the deranged lunatic demagogue from, you know, becoming president. Well, guess what? That's where, you know, that's where we're at.
Right.
The other reasonable defense I've heard, or sort of semi-reasonable, is with all the fuss and concern about voter suppression and, hacking and tampering and, you know, shenanigans and all that, right now, for the most part, you only have to worry about that in the swing states, right? You know, that's where if anybody's going to mess with it, you know, Republicans are very unlikely to try to mess with the California vote because it's almost guaranteed non-starter. And you know, Democrat, or the same thing in, you know, Texas, let's say, states that are or Oklahoma would be a better example because Texas is sort of running purplish. But like in Oklahoma, I don't think Republicans have to even think about like suppressing the vote because they don't need to, you know. Whereas if you went to a popular vote, national popular vote, and got rid of the Electoral College, the claim is, well, then now all of a sudden you're going to have, since every single vote would truly count, now you're going to have all sorts of shenanigans in every single state, and you know, there's going to be problems everywhere, and God help you if you have to do a national recount of all 50 states. It would be a nightmare. No, I agree with that, too. That's a reasonable point. However, first of all, that's a self-created problem, you know. The worst possible outcome of that would be that you would get a demagogue controlled by a foreign power in office. Well, guess what?
Yeah.
The other thing is that what else would happen? Well, here's what else would happen. Several million Republicans did vote for Trump in California. Several million Democrats did vote for Hillary Clinton in Texas. You would see turnout. You want to talk about voter turnout. You would see voter turnout for presidential elections go through the roof because there are millions of Democrats in California and Republicans in Texas and Oklahoma and so forth who didn't vote at all because they figured, why bother? I mean, granted, there's a lot of other reasons to vote, you know, besides president. There's other, you know, there's Senate and governor and the Congress and local offices. But there are a lot of people who don't vote in solidly red or solidly blue states because they figure it's not going to make a difference anyway. On both sides of the aisle, there's lots of Republicans and Democrats in each of those states who don't vote because they know that because they're certain they're going to win or they're certain they're going to lose. And of course, then you have the problems in the swing states like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, where a lot of Democrats didn't bother voting because they assumed that they had it in the bag.
Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what? So what it would, you know, end up with is voter turnout would go through the roof, which I think would also mean that people would pay more attention to the integrity of, you know, to voter suppression and things. I would hope that that would become people would take them much more seriously in every state, and voter turnout would be higher, and hopefully voter awareness would be higher, and people would be paying more attention, and so on, because not only would turnout increase in those states, but it would also increase in the swing states. You know, because if you're a voter, let's say that you're a Democrat here in Michigan who didn't bother voting because you were pretty sure that you were certain that Hillary was going to win. If it was based on the popular vote nationally and you knew that every single vote counted just as much, now all of a sudden you're going to be worried, oh, crap, I better vote because every Republican in Alabama and Arkansas, you know, and then Wyoming is going to be voting. So I damn well better as well.
Yeah.
You know? And the same.
At the same time, you'd have Democrats in Wyoming whose votes don't matter right now coming out to the polls in droves because they would have a chance to actually affect the election at that point. Their votes would matter out in Wyoming. And that might lead to more Democrats being elected in Wyoming.
Exactly. Just not yet down the ballot as well. And the same thing on the Republican side and, you know, in Massachusetts or Vermont or wherever, or California, you might have a few, you know, maybe not for president, but, you know, you might have a few local officials for your side. So yeah, it would increase voter turnout tremendously. I think it would solve a lot more problems than it caused. And the one major defense of, as you just said, the one major defense of the Electoral College system is the exact situation we're in now. And it seems to be the one time when they're not going to actually invoke that.
Yeah, if they refuse to do their duty on Monday, then clearly we should just get rid of them because the institution is pointless. That's what
240 years or something like that we've been around. You know, the one time.
Yeah, exactly.
One time.
In case of emergency, break glass. Well, guess what? They're not breaking the glass.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, Charles, thank you so very much for being with us here today and taking so much time to give us such a fabulous interview. I think these are really difficult topics, even for people who try hard to stay informed and wrap their head around all the different ramifications. I think it's difficult. And thank God you're out there doing such fabulous work to make these things as clear as possible. Folks, if you're on Twitter, please follow Charles. He's a great follow at Charles_Gaba, G-A-B-A. And he's got that, again, that treasured blue check mark, so you'll know you've got the right guy. And he's also online at acasignups.net and brainwrap.com. We're online at imhoppingmad.com. You can hear us on Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, and again, on our website. Thank you so much for joining us here today. This is our last show for 2016. We'll see you in the new year.